Crawford, a Kinder professor in geography. He's also at the University of Oxford. He is well published. He's a senior associate member of the Royal Society of Medicine. His latest book is called Peak Inequality. And again, don't forget, he is going to be cutting his keynote short so that you can interact. So this is a give and take conversation here. Ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce you to Danny Darling. Come on up.
Bonjour. I'm afraid that is it for my French. Grade E, O level. The story I'm going to tell you, I'm going to try and make it not too depressing, and I'm going to try and make it quick, is the story of housing and inequality, but mainly housing in England. Because England is not good at some things. I think it's probably the worst country in the world for learning languages. But we also have a terrible story when it comes to housing. And it's worth saying this now, because it shows what happens if you don't have a goal. If you don't have a goal that nobody should have to pay more than 30% of their income to be housed, it's quite amazing to see just how wrong things can go. There we go. I was born in a little town in the Midlands of England called Oxford in 1968. At the time I was born, my mum and dad could buy a house for £400. Housing was affordable to almost everybody. The men from the car factory, it was a car town, it had a tiny university that was relatively unimportant. It was basically a car town with 40,000 car workers and their families. The men from the car factory were buying houses. They lived in council estates, but they were getting mortgages. When they freed up the council housing, it was available to people in need. Any of my friends who had children early, who had children at school, could get a council house. That is the situation 50 years ago. And then things began to go wrong. We didn't realise what we had. The picture there is a picture taken a couple of weeks ago from an estate agent's window showing houses in the cheapest part of my city. And it's the first time in 50 years that they've begun to fall in price. So if you multiply those figures by 1.7, I think you get a Canadian price. That is the Skid Row of Oxford. That's how much it costs. Average house prices in Oxford are 17 times average income, possibly the highest ratio in the whole of Europe. We compete with San Francisco for unaffordability. I can bore you rigid about what goes wrong when housing becomes this unaffordable. Believe that. Questions and answers if you want to know how on earth do you run a university in a town where housing costs 17 times the average income, and when private rents are double what a mortgage would be. There are superficial reasons given as to why we have a housing problem. This map here shows you the distribution of population in Oxfordshire and England and the distribution of jobs. People say, oh, it's a lack of supply. If you just free up supply, it will solve the problem. We have 40,000 people a day driving over a greenbelt. It's the least greenbelt in the whole of Europe. It creates more pollution than any other greenbelt, because you have to drive cars over it because you cannot live in the city where the jobs are. And you can look at the development of this city. You can look at its growth over time. And you can see how the growth absolutely stopped in the last three decades as it hit bang against the green belt. But that isn't really the real reason for why things have become so affordable in Oxford. And it's not the reason why housing is such a disaster in the UK. We have more bedrooms per person in the UK than we have ever had. We have enough housing for everybody. We put off the bomb. That car factory went from 40,000 workers with families down to 3,000, mainly young men, half of them from Eastern Europe, without families. That freed up an awful amount of housing. That allowed the universities and the hospitals to expand. We had emails until bang, we're full. And then suddenly we have a problem. So what do I think really caused this? And this is going behind the first suggestions made, and behind that. And I know it's early in the morning, but just bear with me. The country I grew up in as a child was the second most economically equal country in the whole of Europe. Only Sweden, for large countries, was more equitable than 1960s, 1970s UK. UK is now the most unequal country in all of Europe. The gap in incomes is wider than anywhere else. It's an incredible change in just 50 years. What you're seeing here is the long-term pattern over centuries for the Gini coefficient, my very fast explanation of the Gini coefficient. I'm sure many of you have come across it before. 0.5 is very high. If we divide this room and everybody from table one over there, we're going to give you an income of $25,000 a year. And everybody here, we're going to give you an income of $75,000 a year. You have a Gini coefficient of 0.5. You're not going to have a couple of holidays. You're going to have somebody clean your house and so on. You lot have no holidays, and some of you clean the houses of these people. That's what 0.5 is. Half of all children in the UK now have no holiday. No going away for a week, apart from going to their grandmothers. That's an incredible change in my lifetime. And different countries have different trajectories. And because of this, and it's only because of this, we're beginning to be able to disaggregate the effects of inequality and to see what happens. The first graph here shows you the trend for the UK and France. It shows you the share of the top 1%. In the UK, the top 1% take about 15% of all income. France chose to go a different way in the 1980s. The median family in France is now 4,000 or 5,000 euros better off each year. The housing is of higher quality in France. It is better insulated. It is larger. The health service works better in France. People live longer in France and so on. Without this experiment, we wouldn't have seen the effects. And the other graph you can see there is the USA and Canada. Now, the divergence between the USA and Canada began more recently. It is absolutely fascinating if you're sitting in Europe. In a way, in North America, you're constructing a natural experiment. What happens when you choose to go one way here and south of the border they choose something else? And we can measure the outcomes in terms of educational performance, in terms of health, in terms of housing. See, now it's not a direct relationship. It's not that the one thing directly causes the other. But to put it very simply, countries which allow the top 1% to take more and more are very badly run and become more and more badly run. And we couldn't have known that in the 1970s, because we were all much more equal. So you didn't have these differences. And we couldn't have known it in the 1920s, because we were all very unequal. It's only been the last couple of decades that we begin to see what happens if you let the free market be. I'm only going to ask you to understand another couple of graphs. The rest of them I'll just click through in their background to make you feel confident. But I would love it if somebody in Canada would replicate this graph. This graph was produced by Becky Tunstall. It uses census data all the way from 1911 through to 2011. Just worry about the top line. The top line is the ratio of the number of rooms per person that the best off 10 have compared to the worst off 10. So way back in 1911, it's a 4. The best off 10 for people in Britain, in a sense, were sitting in a house in which they had 4 rooms per person. The worst off 10 for it was 1 room per person. That means sharing bedrooms for the children. And it got a bit worse by 1921. Inequality increased. But then we became more equal. Gradually fighting for social housing, fighting for council housing, fighting for decent wages, bringing in rent control on landlords, a huge number of events took place. So from 1921 to 31, 41, 51, 61, 71, we reached a heady utopia of the best of 10 having three times more rooms per person than the most crowded tenth of the population. And at that point, we got campaigns, crisis, shelter located, there was a film called Catholic Come Home. We became really bothered. One thing which is fascinating is the countries that are more equal are bothered. If I was given this talk in Norway, and I said, congratulations, you've got the lowest child poverty rate in the world, you're doing brilliant on housing, they would actually shout at me, it's terrible, we're not doing enough. When I do this talk in the USA, and I try to be subtle, but I say, for God's sake, nowhere else in the rich world are children dying this fast. Well, their parents should try harder. It's stunning. It is absolutely stunning. And it's one of the reasons why inequality can be allowed to rise so high, because in unequal countries, people don't see it as a problem. You'll see the rise recently, the rapid rise, so that now the best off 10 have five times more rooms per person in their house than the worst off 10. We have more rooms than we need. We don't have to build anything in the UK. Everybody in London can sleep in a bedroom on their own, not in a hotel or a hostel, in a house. Even if nobody wants to share a bed with anybody else, we actually have enough rooms. What has happened is that we have privatised our housing. In the 1970s, you allocated social housing on the basis of need. You, and normally somebody else, and a couple of kids would turn up at the housing office and say, we need to be housed, we can't stay with my mum anymore. And the four of you would be put in a two-bed maisonette. That two-bed maisonette has now been sold off into the private sector, and it's rented at the highest rent, and it goes to a young professional, one person, rather than four, who is normally very annoyed to be living in an ex-council house. It's an absolute disaster. I've got to think through quickly. So that's our increase over time in inequality. Canada isn't that much better. You're a little bit better. You only look really good because the USA is so awful. That's the effect. And that changes dramatically. I mean, the top line, I'm in at 3%. I'm a university professor. I'm not giving away very much. The entire university professor's done at all. Salary band is from the bottom to the top of 3%. I am a very well off person in the UK. And I'm part of the top 10%, and we take 4/10 of everything. We leave 6/10 to everybody else. Because we're now so unequal, I only just managed to get a mortgage for a house in Oxford. A house four times smaller in volume than the one I grew up in the city. And I'm paying twice what my father was paying in real terms. And I can just house myself. And I am in the 3%. And my children have no chance. And this is why it's getting very interesting. This graph, I apologise for the fact it's almost illegible to read. And on the top you've got time, and down the side you've got age, and the blue band are where the people, the majority, could get a mortgage. And it's called the one lucky generation graph. It's just going away, and we're getting angry young people again, which is good. Angry, young, very middle class, very posh people who realise they're going to have to rent for the rest of their lives. We forget that we had that generation in the past who had to rent from a private landlord. When my granddad was born, it was 90%. We solved it, and then we lost it again. I'm very impressed by what's going on here. 40 billion is a lot, but it's nothing compared to what a few streets in Kensington are worth. We have a bubble in England, and a bubble which is very, very interesting at the moment of what will happen to it. And at the heart of that bubble, we have this little borough, which at one point was worth more than the whole of Denmark in theory, and our banks rely on the loans that they've made with the mortgages, increasingly mortgages given to private landlords, and on the value of this housing. And this housing has been falling, as I'll show you soon, falling in value since July 2016, and you can guess the reason why. And it's interesting times, very interesting times in the UK. And very sad times. Today, Shelter released a report, I read it on the news this morning, we now have 300,000 people homeless in the UK, either on the streets or in temporary accommodation. We haven't had this since the bombing in the Second World War. It's not on the slide because this data came out today, but 2% of the population of London are now homeless, 0.5% of the population of the UK. The number of people found dead on the streets in the last 5 or 6 years has increased eightfold, much faster than the number on the streets, which is also increasing dramatically. As a child, I can remember there were just a couple of old men who were homeless. When I go and talk in schools, the school children say to me, "We'll always have homelessness, we've always had it, it's inevitable." And it's sad to see that happen. The most recent change, and this is in Oxford, is people with all their belongings on the streets. That is new. So this is a kind of warning story about why you must succeed, because it can get much worse. And the tragedy is, when it gets worse, people get used to it being worse and they allow it to be this bad. And the reasons are really obvious. The reasons are really obvious as to why the homelessness is rising. And the government produces statistics, which they ignore, which show you why. This graph is, why have you become homeless graph from official statistics? It's because the private tenancy has been ended by the landlord because they want to lend out to somebody else who's going to pay an even higher rent. That's essentially the reason. To give you a sense of how fast this has occurred in the UK. Again, another official graph. This is the proportion of children in England in private rented accommodation. Just look how quickly things can go wrong. 15 years ago, it was largely a semi-transient population in between moving houses. You wouldn't have a private landlord if you could help, because if you may not know, private landlords can evict people with just 2 months' notice. If you're a child, you need to keep your friends, you need to go to the same school, you can't live in private rented accommodation. But it all fell apart and it all went wrong, with the crash originally, but with people not caring. Now 1 in 4 of all our children are in houses with a private landlord, paying the highest cost. It's the most expensive form of housing. As I said, in Oxford, my house, my mortgage is about £1,200 a month. If I was to rent the house I live in, it would be £2,400 a month. So the families who are having to rent privately are having to pay out so much, 50-60% of their income, for the privilege of insecurity. And that's creating a sense of anger. But there are also a group in Britain who think, oh, we just want to go for it. Just take the state out entirely. Let the market will work it all out perfectly. It will all be okay. If you can't afford to live in a city, you shouldn't be there. If people end up on the streets, it's because they haven't tried hard enough. So we're in a battle at the moment in the UK. I will click over this one. I mean, it matters because it's about the average of Britain and the housing wealth of people by age. And actually, although I'm talking about the most expensive parts of the country, housing is of very low value in other parts and is actually declining in value in Britain. And I'm going to go very quickly through things like this, just to say that we have been here before. This is interest rates in the 1930s. If you want to look back to the last kind of housing crisis that we have now, you have to go back to the 30s. There are towns in the USA where a quarter of the population was squatting in the 30s. We've written that out of our history. But we have a housing crisis before in a similar way. Now there are other similarities. This is the pay of building society bosses in the UK. As things got worse, they paid themselves more. The same thing happened in the UK with bankers until recently. So there are good signs. The chief executive officer pay peaked in the UK in 2015. We're at a cusp. We could go where we are, either way. We could become dramatically more unequal, but one set of people who want the UK to become a Singapore of Europe, the offshore banking centre where the gap between the rich and the poor is even bigger, and there are other people, and you can tell I'm one of them, who want us to become a more normal European country and not be the most unequal country in Europe. How do you become more equal? There are quick ways to becoming more equal. The fastest way to become more equal is to lose a war. Not to be recommended. But when you lose the war, the invading force removed the elite. In the case of Japan, which is the most incredible social experiment, the Americans redistributed the land from the aristocracy as evenly as they could because they were petrified of the communist revolution, creating the most equal country in the world by wealth. And then we watch what happened. And they now live the longest. And the slower way is to become more equal. Here's the Netherlands and Switzerland. And this could be the route that Canada may be on. It is easier. Much, much easier. The reason I partly joke about the war is that the nearest thing to losing a war is a self-inflicted massive economic disaster, which we're currently playing with in the UK. Everything geared up for March 29th. And you know, what I say to my friends and colleagues back at home is, it's better than the war.
Yeah.
And you never know. It might be the thing that actually kicks the UK out of its pole position for inequality. Because inequality is very, very expensive. Three very boring tables for you, but many people don't believe this. Most OECD countries have now passed peak inequality. Income inequalities are falling in most of the world. In the poor world, they're falling. And in most of the rich world, they're falling. In Canada, the Gini coefficient peaked in 2013 at, my eyes actually, is it even not bad? 0.3 something?
0.32.
So not that 75,000, 25,000. Maybe a kind of 65,000, 35,000 kind of. It changes the nature of your society. Changes who your children mix with. Changes how much you weigh about where they go to school. Changes what you think about other people. Changes your politics. Not all countries are falling. Norway's at the peak. But it's a peak only we can only dream of seeing. And even in the UK, we've actually seen our first fall for ages, very recently. And the USA, at the end of Obama, which will be going up again now. But it is not inevitable that inequalities have to rise. In most of the rich world and most of the rest of the world, income inequalities are falling. Wealth inequalities lag decades behind. They will carry on rising, but income inequalities are falling. Why is the Gini coefficient falling in the UK? There's a quote from the Archbishop. He used to be a banker. Only in England would you Archbishop be a banker. But at least he's well informed. And his friends, top bankers were saying, you know, we used to get 10 million a year and now we're getting 5. We can't really complain about it. European Union monitor banking salaries across Europe. UK has 2,700 bankers paid over €1 million a year. 2,700. The next highest is Germany with 197. Yeah. Our bankers said, you have to pay us this much, otherwise we're going to go somewhere else to work. There was nowhere else they could go. Switzerland pays half as much as their bankers. And they do a better job in Switzerland. The one place that pays as much as London is New York. But the American bankers really don't want to give up their jobs. They have a load of blindies coming over. The last 2 years, banking salaries have been falling in the UK. When the banks hire young people now, they ask suddenly, how many passports have you got? But from my university, the ones who've got a European mainland passport are the ones, surprisingly, who are hired. And when they hire them to a bank in London, they say, we'd like you for the first 2 years to work in Amsterdam or Paris or Frankfurt or Dublin, please. It'll just be 2 years. And the salaries are falling. So things are happening. But at the very bottom of society, we're also seeing falls in income. We have a new system of universal credit, which is a disaster. Which is predicted to rapidly increase the homelessness rates in the country. And this is the problem. It's rather like the 1930s. We became more equal in the 1930s, but we became more equal by everybody getting poorer and the rich getting a bit less, seeing their pay drop faster than the poor. Nobody felt good. 3-4 million unemployed. The same is happening now in the UK. This is not the way in which you really want to do it. You want to do it by stopping rises at the top and increasing the bottom and coming together as a nation. That is what they did in Switzerland and the Netherlands, not the way that we're currently doing it. appears the map of the first falls in equity that occurred by August 2016, and we denied they were happening. We denied again for the end of 2016, we denied all the way through 2017. But London house prices are absolutely falling, Oxford house prices are falling, transactions are incredibly low. I know a house that's on the market for 1.7 million, but if you offer the owner a million, they'll sell now. It's really interesting. What kind of an investment is it buying in London today? Would you really put your money from overseas in it? The most interesting thing is that we have an opposition currently leading in the polls, which would tax the hell out of every invested housing in London. So just in case you're advising anybody, please come over and buy the flats. There's no expect to make any money out of them in the future. I've only got 4 slides left, so please think of questions, because I've managed to leave time for questions, and I wanted to make sure we talk about what's of interest to you. I haven't mentioned the kind of good news. There is good news. There is incredible good news, really. Let me go through the good news very briefly. Our current government has actually switched away from the extreme position it's got. All UK governments since the 70s have been moving to more and more individualistic free market system. The first big change occurred in the current government, under George Osborne, about 3-4 years ago, when he increased the taxes on private landlords to try to stop them buying everything. In Oxford, I was competing with 6 landlords to buy my family house. I wasn't competing with anybody else, it was just landlords. I had to offer £100,000 only asking price and send a photograph of my children to get the house I live in. And I'm a statutory professor at the University of Oxford. And I've written a book about housing, so I knew about it. And I drove up in the city and worked for a builder. I have every advantage, and I only just managed it. So Osborne increased taxes on private landlords, they've increased them further, trying to stop people with money just buying houses as an investment, desperately trying to stop amateur landlords. This awful, awful thing is called buy-to-let, where you buy 1 or 2 properties and think you know how to manage them. I mean, we've got to teach the population that being a landlord is as skilled a job as being a head teacher of a school or running a hospital. It is not something that an amateur can do well, and we shouldn't be encouraging that. And on the more progressive side, politics, the Labour Party, you may have known about the news, has moved back towards being a normal social democratic European party. It has become a conservative party. Shadow Housing Minister John Healey announced in February, I think, that if the Labour government comes to power, Labour and the Scottish Nationalists, it will compulsory purchase land on the edge of cities, indeed, at agricultural price, which is essentially zero. So around Oxford, the Free Witches' College are desperately selling their land now. Because whatever you think the chances of a Labour government are, the investment risk of losing that is too high. There is a shift. They lifted the cap to allow local authorities to borrow again. Of course, there's incredibly low rates to be able to build housing again. The government have announced that there will be no more private finance initiatives at all. They will go. And this is our Conservative government, and they're moving to the left. And I'm optimistic, because this is what we saw before. The last peak in inequality was around about 1913, 1918. And from then onwards, all political parties moved to the left and became more progressive. In the 1950s, the Conservative Party in Britain competed and built more council houses each year than the Labour government can manage to do. Can you imagine that? Your political parties competing, all of them, to be more progressive than each other, to better house the population. That's why I grew up in the Child in such a good situation. That's why my friends who found themselves in housing need to be housed, because of that competition between our politicians to make things better in the past. And then from 1979 onwards, we got a competition in the other direction. Can you support people less? Can you allow profit to grow more? It doesn't matter what the rich get as long as they pay their taxes, that kind of thing. And now we're switching around again. I should go back to it and explain why that piece isn't there. But it's mainly because Canada's sitting above the UK and the USA, as I put it there. There are all kinds of relationships of inequality that are absolutely fascinating. One is ability in mathematics. Your entire population becomes worse at maths in countries that become more unequal. And if you want to know why, it's fascinating. But in an unequal country, more people think they can get in the 1%. It's only 1% can ever get in the 1%. And they know that in Scandinavia. UNDEC, student debt. You may not know it. We have university fees of £9,250 a year. In mainland Europe, the fees are essentially zero in most cases. If you have a child who wants to go to university and you want them to learn German, they can go to Germany for free from here in Canada. There are 330,000 overseas students in Germany, more than there are in the UK. The European model is free secondary, tertiary education. And the fascinating thing about inequality is that people in unequal countries don't even know that. The more problem is that people in very equal countries are very modest and don't tend to shout about what they've actually achieved. Here are the huge differences in terms of public spending. Over time, the rise is the bailing out of the banks. And it's showing the proportion of GDP for countries from Finland through to the UK. You see the UK's at the bottom and you see where we're headed, it's IMF figures. The current political debate in the UK between the two main parties is about moving that last bottom line by about 1.5%. Right? And people who don't like the Labour Party say that's irresponsible, you can't possibly spend that much. And the left generally isn't that. But it shows you the wide range of possibilities. Finland is not a basket case. It's the only country in Europe with falling homelessness rate because they have a special program in Finland that Housing First. It has the best educational results in Europe. It has accelerating life expectancy. It has people who, as children, by the age of 15, can speak three languages in a week. So still at school 18, that's almost all of them are. It's six. And then they worry about what their seventh language is going to be. This is a very, very different model. We're living in very interesting times. Brexit may well sort this out. Like all academics, almost all academics, of course, I was in Romania. The fascinating point we've got with Brexit now is in the 585-page report that was published last week. 585 pages. There were only 115 words on banking and finance. We have no agreement on passporting our banks. We are the banking centre of Europe. March 29th is coming soon. They will be allowed to operate for a couple of years. After that, there is no agreement at all. And they're quietly sending out their young bankers to send us across Europe. It's a kind of game of chicken. Shares in Barclays have now fallen by over a third since June 2016. Shares in Lloyds Bank by over half. It's watching market sentiment is fascinating. Watching the value of the pound as it bounces up and down. Remembering that people have forgotten that you can have a run on the currency that's going to occur. And my final slide. This may not mean very much to you. Depends on how it was supported. Simply by putting up that image, I don't have to do anything else in the UK. Simply by putting up that image, people know what it means. If you're not aware, that is Grenville Tower, a tower block, a social housing block in Kensington, where because it was clad with, it's illegal to say this, you get sued, but essentially solid petrol is what the cladding was. Because of the cladding, but also because of the complete lack of care by the local authority, dozens and dozens of people died in that fire. But we've had fires before. That fire became iconic. The fire occurred within 2 weeks of a general election, which saw the biggest swing, than 1945 in public opinion, where the leading government, which already had a majority, the leading party, actually managed to lose its majority when it had called an election to increase it. And after the election and the country in shock because we suddenly realised people can vote in completely unpredictable ways and anything can happen. When this occurred, the Prime Minister was unable to hug anybody. It's not her fault, she just can't do it. It's sad. And poor thing, I didn't even start feeling sorry for her. Which is interesting, she's a graduate of my department. She grew up about 2 miles away from where I grew up. I think she went the wrong way. It's interesting. Once you get enormous sympathy, you kind of lost it as a politician. And the opposition party, of course, were there and matched on the ground. And were hugging people, and not just for the cameras. The point of the picture is that in the foreground, you're looking at the most expensive property in Europe. And the point of cladding the tower wasn't for the benefit of the people inside the tower, it was to make it less of an eyesore for the rich. When that event occurred, everything changed. Everything changed over what is seen as decent and what is allowed. We do have rising numbers of people dying. We'll have more people who die of cold this winter than last winter on the streets of England. We are getting changes, but they're far too small. We have got a crisis. We might do something about it, but we're not doing it in a planned way. And we need to do in England something that we haven't done for decades. We need to go look at a country other than the United States to learn policy from. And there are many, many countries which do housing far, far better than we do. I wanted to give this talk because I wanted to let you know how important it is to try to get it right. Because it's embarrassing. That's despite what happens when you get it wrong. And at least the least thing that England can do is actually explain what happens when you allow selfishness to become so endemic and you believe it's okay for people to make profit and to fund their retirement and multiple holidays off the back of other people's need for shelter. Thank you very much.
I'm kind of embarrassed that I'm coming from the United States. I am Canadian, and for the last few years, I have to admit that I've been wondering what the heck I'm doing over there. I think you just put it into perspective for me. So it is Thanksgiving in the United States, and I give you much thanks that I'm here in town with all of you. And now we're going to open up the floor to questions. And I know I've been seeing people taking photos, writing furiously. I see a hand in the back over here, lady over here, this person over here. So let's start with the back, just because I can't see you and therefore makes it more challenging. There you go. Keep waving your hand so that we can see where you are. You guys get ready.
Thank you. It's a very interesting talk, and I guess my question is whether or not you have any data that are disaggregated in terms of race, gender, and so on and so forth. And the reason why I'm asking is that in Canada, we have an issue of certain communities are more likely to live in poverty. The income disparities are not felt equally among different communities. Indigenous groups is one in particular, but other communities as well. And your example of the United States, and you know, children dying and nobody care. And I wonder if that has something to do with the fact that if you're a black child, you're 2.5 times more likely to die than a white child in the United States. And I remember an article in the New York Times saying that the racial inequality among infant mortality rate is now greater than before emancipation. So just your thoughts on whether or not other factors are at play as well.
Thank you very much for that. The biggest gap in Britain is money, is income and wealth. And one unusual thing about Britain is that there are people who are very rich who are not white in Britain. However, from the 2001 census, it's the last time it's counted, if you do a horizontal slice across the country, the majority of children living on the fifth floor or above, which is mainly in London Tower Blocks and Birmingham Tower Blocks, the majority of children are not white. And that statistic, when the fire happened and you saw who died in the fire, it was a minority of people in that particular tower block. whereas the majority in the rich parts of Kensington are white, including their nannies, who are white, because Finland is the favourite place to get your nannies from. We have a series of statistics. Bangladeshi families do particularly badly, Pakistani families do particularly badly. We invited people to come when we couldn't get a workforce for the night shift in the mills. We couldn't. When we came, we offered them the worst housing areas of the country. I'll just give you one example. You've heard of the Notting Hill Carnival? And you may have wondered why Notting Hill was an area associated with West Indians. During the Second World War, there came a point when V2 rockets could actually reach to West London. And V2 rockets were particularly scary because you could hear them. And then they cut out. And then I think you know you've got 12 seconds before they come down. The middle class fled Notting Hill. The East Enders had already been bombed out. And so they squatted in Notting Hill. And then after the war, they sublet to West Indian immigrants. And that's why this incredibly, in the past, affluent part of West London became associated with a particular ethnic minority. It's now reverted back to being white and rich again. In a country that's so divided by money, all these other divisions are exacerbated by it. And the last thing I forgot to say, that the people most affected by the cuts are women and children. And the group most affected of all are single parents, who in the vast majority of cases are single mothers. That is the group who have been targeted. On the other side, although I said the government has done some good things, they've cut corporation tax down to a European minimum, they've cut taxes at the top, and the people who've benefited from that are mainly white men.
Hello, thank you very much for your terribly sad story. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on how you think Canada, with the virtue of having the CMHC, how you think it should look at its key performance indicators, which are around things like innovation and risk management. How do you think it could orientate its activities to have the greatest outcomes for social housing? I know, for example, they are trying to do more, but we hear, as visitors here, that it's very, very difficult and bureaucratic and slow and hard to actually get access to investment in their organisations and also direct investment grants.
Yeah.
Can you give us some inspiration for how they could do even better?
Okay. There's a couple of things. One thing is to take a 2030 target for, say, nobody paying more than 30% for housing and break it down to what you have to achieve each year to get to it. That's ever so easy. And then each year work out if you're on track to do it. Over money, over getting more than 40 billion, the rich of the world are desperate to lend their money at the moment. They're absolutely desperate. They're partly desperate because investment returns are falling everywhere. So you need a freeing up of the ability to borrow at really low rates, 4.5% over 100 years, that kind of thing. The money is there to do it that way. But the other thing is to look at your property that's empty or unused second or third or fourth or fifth homes. I remember John McCain. I think he had 11 in the States and lost count. Look at second, third, fourth homes that are empty. Look at how many bedrooms are empty in houses. Look at whether that's increasing. And then look at countries elsewhere in the world. All states in the USA. There are more liberal states in the USA that have local property taxes that encourage somebody not to live in a six-bedroom house on their own. You never stop anybody doing it. Right? That's wrong. You put in the property taxation system means that if you want to live in a six-bedroom house on your own, you're going to pay for the privilege by giving money to the local municipality that it will use to house people in other ways. But look to Austria, look to Vienna, look to the Netherlands. Look at the property taxes that are in place elsewhere in those countries where people are paying no more than 30% of their income for housing. And also be shocked at how better quality the housing is. One thing that shocked me is how the market manages, if you leave it alone, to produce the worst quality housing at the highest price. We've been teaching a particular kind of economics 101 since the 80s that just says individual consumers are the best judges and they'll get it right. And we've forgotten there are some people who are greedy. And those people who are greedy will work very hard to make money out of other people. And the thing about housing is you all have to be housed. It's a captive market, it's a monopoly. So you need to understand this is different from other goods. And the last thing to say is efficiency. We now have more and more empty houses in the middle of London, bought as investment properties. Lord Tebbit, who was a minister under Margaret Thatcher, complained recently that when his chauffeur drove him from the House of Lords, he had to drive him many, many dozens of miles past homes where he could see the lights were off, because Lord Tebbit couldn't actually afford to live near where he was working. And the irony was that he engineered the thing that made this happen to him. Look at the existing property is really, really important. I know building is important, it matters. Oxford is one of the places that could do with some building. But in general, you solve most of your housing needs with your existing stock. And in particular, the stock which is privately owned, you have to ensure you don't get the situation that we have in the UK, where we have, opposite me, an elderly woman sitting in a house she owns that she cannot heat or clean because it's too big. She just lives in half of it. But she's waiting out her days, because the longer she can last in that house, it's largely empty, the more money she can give to her grandchildren when she dies, and they might have a chance. I mean, that is the most ridiculous situation to get into, when families become their own individual little welfare states, and that results in incredible inefficiency in housing.
Thank you.
Sally,
I know a lot of people.
Yes. Hi. I work in an organization that is housing committees and tenants associations across the Quebec province. And we mostly fight for right to housing and social housing development. And I wanted to touch base on a particular London experience. As you may know, the National Housing Strategy includes a individual allowance that would enable people to raise their available income for themselves to house themselves on the private market. In Quebec, we have such a small program relating to rent supplement, which is usually used in emergency cases. And what we've seen in our own province is that supplement, individual supplement, has had very few control on quality of housing, sanitary conditions, and is in previewed on a up to 110% market price. So I wanted to hear you, because we often hear about the London experience with the local housing allowance that was put forward, and the studies I read on it was that, you know, there were important critics relating to how rent rose throughout the program, particularly in parts where rent was lowest at the time that was implemented, and often rising much above inflation. So I wanted to hear your thoughts on that. You know, because our preoccupation is that it is more of a private market oriented tool, and we have little regulation on private market right now. We have very few provinces apart from Quebec that have rent control that actually sort of works.
Yes.
So if you could tell us a little bit about the dangers maybe of the individual allowance for housing.
It's very dangerous. Even we have the single housing benefit that got bigger and bigger and bigger. Essentially, you need to have a child to get it. So if there's two of you and you have two kids and you split up, you take one child each, because you must have a child to get the housing benefit. And then the state, indirectly through you, because you've got a child, is paying the landlord this rent. I really want to say it's not a market rent. It's called a market rent, but it isn't. Right? It's a rigged market rent. You know, when I was a student, I paid £9 a week in Newcastle to rent a house. In the second year, I paid 13. The landlord wasn't spending £9 on the property. That kind of property would now cost £600 a month. But it's not costing the landlord that much to do the upkeep of it. It's not a market. It's a rigged market. And it's not understanding that, not realising how badly the market works. You need a private rented market. I mean, posh people like me moving between cities always kind of want to be, you know, in something like that. But you need to regulate it. So look to Germany. And the way it works, most of Europe has rent regulation. The way it works is that you have to buy your tenants out. You cannot actually increase the rent, you cannot evict them, you have to bribe them to a point they're willing to leave. That's how you know they're happy tenants. But also, the tenants actually have a responsibility to fit the house out, change the kitchen. They do all of that. And because they know they can be there for as long as they want, they make it fit and habitable. And that's how you get a really high quality private rented sector, is giving the tenants the actual ability to decorate and regenerate the housing. There are many other things that can be done. We used to have a rule in the UK that if a property was left vacant to private rented for 6 months, it could be compulsory purchased by the state. And that encouraged the landlord to actually do it up and rent it out. I would be in favour of policies that say that if a dwelling is inspected and it isn't of high enough quality, it should be compulsory purchased at a discount by the state. The landlord should no longer own it. I'd like to see a right to sell to the state as well as a right to buy. And also tenants should have the right, if the property is not well maintained, to go to local authority and ask for the housing to be transferred to the ownership of the local authority. You'd be amazed how well landlords will start to behave if they think they could actually lose their property. And the problem is, the way it works in the private rented sector, if I became a landlord and I cared a little bit too much, I wouldn't make the profit I would need to buy the next house and the next house. So we've actually set up a system which is discriminates against landlords who care and actively increases the proportion of landlords who are completely heartless, because they do well by not fixing things, not maintaining it, and they buy more properties and they get more and more rent. If you're trying to design a system to house people badly, that the free market system with no regulation is quite incredible over what it can occur. To the point in Oxford where we have PhD students from very wealthy families who are paying their own fees, £20,000 a year, who are actually renting substandard rooms and sharing illegally with other PhD students because we've allowed the market to rip so much. So it's affecting the children of the super rich. Well, this is the irony of how bad it can get. Who don't dare say anything, because in fact legally you can't have four people in those houses.
Thank you very much for giving me a different perspective. My name is Mojica. I work for Wood Green Community Services. We have a significant housing for the most disadvantaged group in our population, so and I won't care to name that. But that's where I come from. I have a couple of things. From yesterday's discussion, I was actually left a little bit discouraged, because I kind of thought that we have to be careful in the conversations we're having in this room, so that we don't hand the right wing the trump card they need in order to talk to people the way they talk to people and assure them of the promises that they can fulfill. And one of the things about yesterday that for me was a little bit disingenuous, to put it bluntly, was overplaying the fact that the financialization of the housing market is the big evil thing here. And I was left feeling that the only road out of that, the only outcome out of that conversation, is to generate war between class wars, between rich and poor, those who own a home and those who don't own a home, a generational fight between mom and dad who own a home and now have a kid with so much equity versus me who is just starting school and I just finished and I don't have that. So, and I think the British experience for me is interesting for you to sort of help reflect on how you actually have that conversation without necessarily ending up in a situation where you create that kind of conflicted language that the right wing sees on and who we're only a year away from the election, and if that is how the housing problem is going to be framed in that context, we're going to lose a lot of people because there is a truth to the financialization of the market which we cannot escape, and that is it allowed immigrants like me who came here 25 years ago and with a decent income, like many others, not everybody does, to be able to move into home ownership and now have equity like everybody else, right? And I'm just giving myself as an example. So I think, and also I didn't think there's anything wrong with the fact that the pension funds have moved their money from the dot-com type of technology to housing, because I think housing is about people more than the technical.
Yeah, that's a good thing. It's what, and it happens in Germany.
Yeah.
Pension funds are landlords.
Yeah.
In Germany, and they are well-behaved landlords because they know what they're doing. But my problem with landlords is somebody like me being a landlord. You know, is this somebody's home? And the idea of me doing that. You're completely right about the. This is what we have in Britain. We have 40% of people who support the Conservative Party who own their house outright and think it's worth £300,000 or £400,000 or £500,000. And we have 40% of people supporting the Labour Party who are largely younger and don't. The people who own their house outright have not yet worked out that there is nobody to buy their property at £300,000 or £400,000 unless they sell to landlords. So the only way that they actually realise the equity that they already think they have. It's making people think equity is an estimate of the money you'll get. I worked out that George Osborne's prediction for what's going to happen to the house prices in London in 2015 could only happen if aliens descended from another planet and come in bars of catalysts to buy it. So it's a class war between people who think they've got the wealth and haven't, and young people who are very angry but don't realise that life cannot be that easy necessarily.
Thank you.
Thank you for your nice presentation. I would like to bring, after 60 years on this earth, I don't know where I was before, because he didn't give us a right to keep memory of all the reincarnation that wasn't ever. I always see that wealthy people need poor people to maintain their status. So for me, came to the conclusion that equality between people is not a natural thing. And it's not even between plants, insects, or whatsoever. So starting from the point that the wealthy at some point understand that they need to keep the poor wealthy enough to keep them earning and spend for the wealthy to maintain their status. And one example of that is Bill Gates, the window guy. At 1.2 years ago, he mentioned in an interview that we should tax robot work. Why? Because robots doesn't spend, doesn't consume things that they are producing.
Okay, I'm gonna try and answer that one. It varies over time. So we always have inequality, but the extent of inequality varies. Sometimes it's very wide, sometimes it's very narrow. So there isn't a natural level you have to have. Wherever you have wealthy people, very wealthy people, you always have poor people. It's impossible. You're not wealthy unless they're poor people. Being wealthy means somebody is changing the sheets in my hotel bedroom. You know, the whole point about being wealthy is you don't have to do things for yourself. The most common job for women 100 years ago in my country was to work in service as a maid. But it's quite possible to get rid of that. We largely got rid of that. Almost nobody, when I was a child, was working as a servant. People did their own washing, it was women. And then we slowly managed to get men to do some of that. But the tragedy is now we've seen an increase in servants again. So it is rising. But you can have very harmonious societies with very low gaps between the rich and the poor. And in the places you get those harmonious societies, things happen that you can't imagine. In Japan once, I had an interpreter who went to the equivalent school to Eton. It's actually paired reason, which is what it's called in England. But she had no accent. So nobody she was talking to could tell she was posh by how she spoke. Whereas, believe you me, in England, they can tell my class background pretty fast. And I can tell theirs. In fact, what we do, we just look at the clothes. It's an English thing, I can tell you about it if you want to know. And you see, there's a little difference. In Scandinavian countries, you don't worry about where your child goes to school. You go to the nearest school, it is of a good quality, and you enjoy the fact that your children interact with other children. In the city of Oxford, a third of the children the age of my children are going to private schools. My children never meet them, not at parties, not at events, ever. It has a segregation rate which is similar to South Africa under apartheid. And they're paying. Most of my colleagues are paying for their children to be finally educated away from the rest. Not just because they will get slightly higher grades, but also so they don't mix later. And that's a horrible situation to get into.
Thank you, Danny. I really don't want to cut you off, but we are out of time. What I can say, however, is that we're going to take a 15-minute break. So I invite all of you to grab a coffee. Danny, can you stick around and if people want to talk with you? That would be wonderful. Thank you so very much.